Okay, welcome everyone. We are on 18A, Yudches Amud Aleph in Makos. And so again, I'm joined with Melissa and Sammy here in person, Marina, Phyllis two times. I see Phyllis on two screens over here. And Erwin, good to have you with us.
I have to get rid of one.
This is a last minute change that had to be made for today. So I appreciate everyone's flexibility. God willing, the rest of the crew will get the recording. So we need to orient ourselves. We are in the middle of a discussion here in the Gemara. And so we need to take a little bit of a step back so we can understand what we are up to. You came in the middle of a little bit of a piece, so hopefully it'll still be beneficial. So there's a little bit of background I'll try to give for everyone. All right, there is an echo coming from your side, Phyllis. I just muted that. No offense. So what we learned last time is as follows. We talked about how from one pasuk only, which if you actually look back on Yitzayin Amav in 17a in the Torah HaShalem, the pasuk was Lo sucha lecho bisharecha. You're not able to eat in your gate. Masar de gancha v'siroshcha v'itzarecha v'choros v'karcha v'tzonecha, etc., etc., etc. All these different kinds of categories, which the verse told us that if you eat them outside of the walls of Jerusalem, you incur malchus, you get lashes for that. And so what we used that pasuk for was we did a bunch of kal v'chomers. What we did was as follows. We said, wait a minute, Leslie, Meiser Shani, I have an obligation to bring it up to Yerushalayim and to eat it inside the walls of Yerushalayim. Meiser Sheni is the lowest level of sanctity of all the other categories in the verse. All the other categories were things like offerings that are brought in the temple. We talked about Bechoros, firstborn offerings. We talked about Shlamim. We talked about Kachi Kachim, which are even holier offerings, such as Asham and Nechatos, which are atonement offerings. And then finally, we hit the crescendo, which is a Karban Olam, which is so, you know, sacred, one could say, that it's only consumed by the altar, by God, so to speak. Of course, God's not eating it, but it's something that we dedicate completely to Hashem, and because it's so sacrosanct, it's sanctified. Now, what we concluded saying was, Rava had this, I don't know if you call it an outrageous statement, but this is what I love doing in Makos. You'll have these cases where I just do one thing, but somehow I violated five different Isurim in the Torah all at once. So what was our case? The case was, if you're following, so we are Yudches Amud Aleph 18a. We are five lines down from the top. The word gufa. Gufa, on the matter we were just discussing, Amar Rava Zar Sha'acha Min Ha'ola Lifnei Zerika Chutz Lachoma, a Yisrael, a non-Kohen, who eats an Ola offering before the blood is thrown and offered, outside, and he consumes it outside the walls of Jerusalem, L'Rabbi Shimon Loke Chamesh, he gets five sets of lashes for that. Why is that? So let's enumerate them. Number one, because he ate outside the walls of Jerusalem. Number two, he consumed it before the blood was thrown, lifnei zrika. Number three, he's a czar. Since he's a czar, he's not a kohen, he shouldn't be eating kachei kachim, the higher level of karbanos, of offerings. And then also, he ate it not only outside the walls of Jerusalem, but of course, he also, by virtue of doing that, consumed kachei kachim outside of the Beis HaMikdash, outside of the temple. Kachei Kachim, because of its elevated sacred status, must be consumed not only within Yerushalayim, but within the temple grounds, within the Azara, the courtyard area. If you eat it outside, that's another issue to add to the tally. And then finally, he's eating an Ola offering, which is the offering that only goes to Hashem. No one's allowed to partake in other than God. And therefore, by a Zar, a non-Kohen, eating a carbonola outside the walls of Yerushalayim, he violates five prohibitions and would incur five sets of malchus, of lashes, based on that. That's what we learned last time. I want to pause briefly for a moment for clarification questions. If there's, because the Gemara we're going to do now is predicated on our understanding of this. So I know I just re-threw out a lot of things that we did. Ah, Sammy, so what do you got?
I thought that Malchus was one of the sparrow. Is that not what it is in this context?
Well, and it, right, so what Sammy's saying is Malchus, which it sounds similar, it's spelled differently. This is Malchus with a kuf. What you're thinking is Malchus with a chuf. Right. So that means kingship. And right, yeah, it sounds similar.
Okay,
and so that's also the sphera. You're not really going to see discussion of that in the Gemara because that's a Kabbalistic concept. And the Gemara does have some interesting supernatural things you'll find in here. Not what we're up to right now, but later in Malchus, we'll get a little bit of that. So it's a Malchus, a very important term. That refers to lashes that are administered by the rabbinical court for violating certain prohibitions in the Torah. So, okay, here's what we're going to do. As if five sets of lashes were not enough, we weren't content with five. You know, I remember one time when I was in ninth grade and we had math class, and the punishment was every time you spoke out of turn, you get assigned more homework. And so there was one friend we had. He just, A, he was a loudmouth, B, math was super easy for him, and I dare say he even enjoyed doing math. So what he would do is he'd speak out of turn, and the teacher would be like, that's 10 more questions you got to do in your homework. He's like, that doesn't matter to me. That's 10 more. And he would just like build it up until like, you know, there was nothing left for him to assign to him. So that's kind of what we're doing over here, which is, five sets of 39 lashes. That's nothing. I could take much more than that. Well, let's see if we could find a reason for a czar, a Yisrael who eats it from a carbon ola outside the walls of Jerusalem to incur even more malchus. So what we're going to do is we're going to bring in a few other psukim in the Torah that would seem to be telling us that a czar that eats from an ola should be getting even more malchus. Each time a pasuk would tell us that a czar should not eat an ola would be grounds for an additional set of malchus. We already know, by the way, when I was initially reading the Gemara, it wasn't clear to me. So if it wasn't clear to me, maybe a few of you will benefit from this clarification. We already learned last time through a Kal Vachomer that a czar, I'm explaining the Gemara simply according to one school of Rishonim, that we already know you get malchus if you are not a Kohen. Sorry, if you're anyone who really eats an ola. Anyone who eats a carbon ola gets malchus because you're not supposed to eat carbon ola. But if we have additional psukim that also say that you get punished for eating a carbon ola, then that would just add more sets of malchus for all the violations that you've committed. So let's go through it. Here are the suggestions the Gemara gives us. Vililki nami mishum v'zar lo yochal ki kodesh heim. Maybe, so this pasuk is taken from the Miluim when they were initially dedicating the Mishkan. It says in that verse that a czar, a non-Kohen, may not partake in the food of these offerings, for they are sacred. Maybe this verse also should tell me that when a czar eats from a carbon ola, from an ola offering, he also should get an additional set of malchus, because in addition to what we learned previously, he's also violating this additional pasuk. However, the Gemara says, this pasuk can't be coming to tell us the prohibition of eating from a carbon ola, even if you're a czar. Why? Hani mili hecha dela kohanim chazi. This verse comes to exclude a non-Kohen from eating, which implies that it's mutter. What we're discussing this verse is mutter for a, just a moment, for a Kohen to eat. However, hacha le kohanim nami lo chazi. The context of this verse is only discussing things that are not permissible for Yisrael, but permissible for a Kohen. And therefore, since an Ola is usher to Kohanim, the same way it's usher to Yisraelim, this verse can't be talking about a carbon Ola, which doesn't discriminate between Yisraelim and Kohanim, right? The carbon Ola is very nice. It doesn't discriminate. Rather, it says everybody gets nothing. Nobody's allowed to eat from me, it says. Okay.
I think it's obvious by the name of Ola that it's not for anybody to eat. That it's Olel Hashem. Completely.
So you are correct, Phyllis. That part, right, it would seem self-explanatory. The issue is from a halachic standpoint, the way the halachic legal system works is we can't just simply look at the word of something in the Torah and then infer the halachic meaning because, you know, the good old example of eye for an eye, well, without rabbinic understanding, you'd be led to the wrong conclusion. So you are correct. Just pshuto shel mikra, a carbon ola sounds like something that completely goes up.
Compared to the other carbonot.
What was that?
Compared to all the other carbonot.
Certainly, certainly. Now, but what we're doing here is no one's disputing that. No, one is not. We're not disputing here whether one can eat a carbon ola or not. We're trying to figure out if this particular verse would be an additional prohibition to eat a carbon ola for Yisrael. We say it doesn't make sense because this pasuk is only prohibiting it for Yisrael, not for a kohen. And therefore, whatever this pasuk is talking about, it can't be talking about a carbon ola because the carbon ola is usher to Yisrael and a kohen alike. That's what the Gemara says. And if you got that, it's going to be a very similar logic for the rest of the Shakavataria of this piece of the Gemara. V'lilkinami mishum ubasar besada trefa loso chelub. Maybe also, let's look at a different verse. This one is found in Exodus and Shemos, Perachav Beis, Pasuk Lamed Aleph, chapter 22, verse 30. It says, V'anshe kodesh tiyuni, that you shall be holy people unto me. Ubasar basada trefa lo sochelu, la'kelev tashlichuno. So this is the famous verse, or I shouldn't say famous, because maybe we don't know about it. This is the classic verse that tells us that if we have tray food, don't throw it out, but rather throw it to the dogs. Why do we do that? Probably to show Hakar Satov for the dogs, how they treated us in Egypt, as the classic explanation goes. So perhaps, now the question is as follows. Tray food is tray. You know, whether I shechted it inside the shul over here, I remember when I was in Darche, I remember when I was in middle school, they brought a cow or a bull or something on campus, and they're like shechting it on campus. So all I do is remember. I remember the bull running around. They're trying to. It was crazy. They're trying to make sure it stays tamed. I missed the shechita. I don't know. I guess the little kids weren't allowed to watch it. Maybe I'm not sure. Or I just ditched that part. I'm not sure why I would want to ditch that of all things. But a trefa, an animal that's a trefa. What's a trefa again? Nevela is an animal that's kosher, but you didn't slaughter it properly. A trefa could be an animal that was slaughtered properly, but has a hole in its lung, and therefore we know it's going to die within a short amount of time, and therefore that's called a trefa. By virtue of it dying very soon, it invalidates the food. It's not kosher. So that doesn't matter whether it's in the field or not. I don't care whether a trefa animal is in the field or whether it's inside my house or inside the barn. So the word basada in the field seems to be superfluous, and it must be coming to tell me something that I would not have known otherwise. That's how good old hermeneutics work. So maybe it's coming to tell me, kevan sheyatza basar chutz lemechitza so nesar. Since the meat, once meat is brought outside of its designated area, it's usur for you to eat. So what are we suggesting here? Maybe this verse could be another proof text that when I have meat, like a carbon ola, and I take it out of the Beis HaMikdash, I take it out of the temple for me to eat, I should incur additional malchus for violating this verse because this verse prohibits me from taking something that is otherwise edible, otherwise I'm permitted to eat. But when I remove it from its designated area of consumption where I'm supposed to consume it, I get malchus. Well, this would not give us malchus in a case, again, of consuming a carbon ola. Why? Because hani mili hecha debifnim chazi. Hecha bifnim nami lo chazi. Yes, but this verse assumes that we're talking about a kind of carbon, a kind of offering that I would be allowed to eat if I was eating it in the right place. A carbon ola, even if I'm in, you know, the Kodesh HaKadoshim, I'm as deep into the Beis HaMikdash as possible. I shouldn't be there for other reasons. But I'm all the way inside the Beis HaMikdash. It doesn't matter. I'm not allowed to eat a carbon ola anywhere because it goes to God. So this verse, which is distinguishing between eating something in its proper place or an improper place, can't be pertaining to our case of a carbon ola, because a carbon ola is prohibited irrespective of where it's being consumed. So we have to reject that suggestion as well. Third suggestion number three, I believe out of four. Vililki nami kitir Rabbi Eliezer, Domer Rabbi Eliezer, maybe once you get Malchus, based on how Rabbi Eliezer understands the following pasuk. Lo yochal ki kodeshu. It says that one should not eat, for it is kodesh. So if you just look, it's Shmos Chav Tes Lamed Dalet. It's Dalet on the side of your Gemara if you have the Torah Shalem. Mivasim yibsar hameluim min alechem ad haboker. This is referring to Nosar. So we're about to flip the page. Now, what is Nosar? Let's remind ourselves what Nosar is. Nosar is generally, the rule is, when you bring a particular carbon, you bring a particular offering, there is a prescribed amount of time that I must consume that offering in. The carbon Pesach must be consumed before midnight, arguably until Alos HaShachar, until the morning. A Shlamim offering, you have, I believe, one night and 2 days to finish it. Basically, once the deadline is passed and you did not consume the carbon during its prescribed time, it becomes what we call Nosar, it's leftovers. And this verse tells me that I'm not allowed to eat leftovers. Now, the thing is, it says, Lo yachel ki kodeshu. Why did it need to add in the words ki kodeshu? For it is sacred. All the verse needed to say was, don't eat it. That's it. What do the words ki kodeshu, for it is holy, come to tell me? They are otherwise superfluous. So they must be coming to tell me a halacha. Kol sheva kodesh pasul, anything that's kodesh that becomes pasul because you brought it into a circumstance that rendered it invalid. This verse serves as a proof text to tell me anytime that you have a carbon that is permissible for you to eat, and then you wait or you actively bring it into circumstances that render it invalid, you then there is an issur, there's a prohibition to eat it. So maybe this should also be not just a proof text for Nosar, but should be a proof text for a carbon ola as well. That when I eat a carbon ola outside the Beis HaMikdash or even outside the walls of Yerushalayim, I should get an additional round of malchus for that, because I rendered it pasul by taking it outside of the Beis HaMikdash. The issue is, the same logic applies here again. This verse assumes that there was at least some point in time that it would be permissible for me to eat something. I was allowed to eat the carbon shlamim, but then the deadline passed, now I can't eat the carbon shlamim. Therefore, I get malchus for eating it after the deadline. Well, actually, you really wouldn't get malchus, because when it comes to nosar, nosar is a lafanite klase, because it says if you wait too long to eat the nosar, then you have a mitzvah, a positive mitzvah, to burn the leftover food. So since you have what's called lavanitik maaseh, a positive mitzvah that's there to rectify a sin that we committed, you wouldn't get malchus. That's what we talked about previously. Anyway, coming back to our discussion, a carbon ola was never permissible. I was never allowed to eat a carbon ola. So this verse, which is telling me it's usur, you get malchus for eating this carbon after its prescribed time or bringing it into invalid circumstances. There's no such thing as bringing the ola into invalid circumstances. It was always disqualified. You were never permitted to eat an ola. Therefore, this verse can't be coming to discuss an ola and to add additional malchus to the ola. It must be talking about something else. Which brings us to our final suggestion. Maybe another teaching of Rabbi Eliezer will enlighten us. Rabbi Eliezer taught, any kind of offering which is described as bichalil tiyah, it should be utterly consumed. This comes to teach us that there is a losase that you get malchus when it has the words bichalil tiyah. Therefore, the Gemara finally gives up. The Gemara concedes. Ein hachinami, right? You ever talk to yeshivish guy? That's what they say. You ever like make a good, this is yeshiva speak right now. This is yeshiva charade, as they call it, the sprach. That when you tell somebody, you make a good point, and they have to concede, they're like, ein hachinami, okay, you're right. So they didn't just make it up in the 20th century. It's from the Gemara, of course. Ein hachinami, or in hachinami. V'rava mehai kraka amar. What was Rava talking about? Rava's like, yes, of course. Of course there's room for additional malchus. Of course we could find more reasons to give this guy malchus if we really want to. We have all these wonderful psukim lined up, so many opportunities to get malchus. Ah, beautiful, right? But when Rava said, I mean facetious, don't worry. When I'm not looking to give people malchus. Just my sense of humor. Now, as what's Rava talking about, that you only get five sets of malchus? What Rava means to say is you only get five sets of malchus from the verse that starts Lo sucha lechol bisharecha. That's what we spent the last 2 weeks analyzing, that particular pasuk. But of course, if we expand our horizons and we're not myopic, we don't limit ourselves to just one verse taken out of context in the Torah, and we look at the whole plethora of different kinds of psukim the Torah has to offer us, certainly we can find a basis for more malchus if we are really looking for that. That's the conclusion of this part of the Gemara. And now we will move on to part two in just a moment. I'll pause for questions. Thank you for joining us, Melissa. Thanks for fitting it in. Okay. The door over there should be unlocked. Okay. All right. Shkoach. Okay. Thank you, Melissa. Have a wonderful evening. Any questions at this point? Anything we could address?
I have one that I forgot what
it was. Oh, okay. Well,
I think it was about the meaning of a word.
Meaning of a word.
I don't remember what word it is.
Well, if you remember, you could stop me and I'll give you the translation for it.
Okay.
All right. There are a few words that over the course of the weeks, what I do is each time there's new terms, I do key terms, and so people will write them down. So there might be a few I'm already assuming everyone's familiar with. So you.
No, it was like more like, I think it was like something like the time before, like where like it was used in a different way than I've seen it. I think it was like the past. I don't remember.
Okay, sure. So if and when you find it, I'm happy to translate it. Okay. The next part of the Gemara I found a little bit, you know, it's still, of course, it requires our Gemara cups when you think about it, but it's a little bit more straightforward, a little bit less, I'd say, technical in that regard, in the regard that we had before. Amarav Gidel Amarav. I mean, don't get your expectations too high. Kohen Sha'achal Mechatas Va'ashim Lefnei Zrika. If a Kohen, we're no longer talking about a Zar, we're no longer talking about Yisrael, we're talking about a Kohen who's allowed to eat from Karbanos. But however, even though Kohanim are allowed to eat from most karbanos and are supposed to, they are only allowed to eat once the rituals are done. They're only allowed to eat once the blood. So what happens is when you slaughter a karban, they collect the blood, they throw it onto the altar. That's part of the ritual. It's integral to it. And that basically is the point. Let's say you're bringing a chatas or ashan, an atonement offering. The atonement is only effectuated at the point that the blood is thrown, not prior to that. Therefore, if a kohen eats a machatas or asham atonement offerings before the throwing of the blood, loke, he incurs malchus. He shouldn't have been a glutton. He should have had some patience. My time up, but where do we know this from? To Amar Kra, as we learned in the Pasuk, v'achlo asam asher kupar lahem, la'achar kapar in, lifnei kapara lo. So it says, and they shall eat from it, and it shall be a kapara for them. So what this implies is, after the kapara, after the blood is thrown, yes, before the kapara, before the atonement? No. And I'll just finish this one line. And I'll take your question. So what this tells us is a lav haba mechlal say lavu. If there is a key term or key concept you want to walk away with today, this is a very important concept to remember that will come up again. A lav haba mechlal say is basically in the Torah, it gives us a positive mitzvah. You shall eat from the sacrifice after blood is thrown. The lav haba mechlal say means I infer a lav, a negative commandment, from the statement of a positive commandment. It says in the Torah, thou shalt eat from the karban after the blood is thrown. I can infer from there that it's usur, it's prohibited for me to eat prior to the blood being thrown. It doesn't say in the Torah, thou shalt not eat before the blood is thrown, but I can infer from the fact that it says, eat only afterwards, that it's usur for me to eat it beforehand. So that's called a lav haba mechlal say, a negative commandment inferred from a positive commandment. Just pause for a question for a moment. Sam, you had a question.
Yeah, aren't kapara like the same on Yom
Kippur?
Ah,
very good, very good. So Sammy brings up that we're using the term kapar, which means an atonement. And this is very on theme. Sammy points out that before Yom Kippur, right, some people take chicken, some of us, most of us, I think, take money. And we do kaparos. So we shake it around and we say, right, zek parasi, zek halifasi. And so, actually, you're correct, Sammy. It's the same word. Kaparos means an atonement. So we believe that when we have that chicken and then we slaughter and we give it to the poor, or we just take money and we give that money to the poor, it serves to atone, help atone for our sins. So it's, you're correct. The exact,
so it is the same.
It's the same word. Yes. This is actually the same word. Now, whether one should be doing it with a chicken or not, you know, it's funny. I saw a comic, actually. That came out a few years ago, and it shows a chicken on a cross, and it says, "I died for your sins." So it's, you know, when I first saw it, I'm like, "Yeah, you know, it's such a barbaric practice." But then I was thinking, not to say we can't do it in a way that's more ethical and a way that's a little bit more sensitive to tzar bali chaim, not inflicting pain on the animals, but you know, karbanos, animal sacrifice, was part of the temple service, so. You know, even though kaparos might be arguably a newer innovation, the notion of me rejecting it on the basis of saying we shouldn't sacrifice animals to God for atonement, well, that is very much rooted in halacha. Now, can we do it in a more ethical way, in a way that's more sensitive to the animals? We did a shiur about a year ago on eating veal and eating foie gras, Phyllis, if I pronounced it correctly, which is basically these are calves or geese that are force-fed, and they're kept in terrible conditions. So Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Adi Yosef, in two separate shuvos, one talking about veal, one talking about foie gras, both said it's usur to eat them, one, because they might become trefos because they're in such terrible conditions, but B, because you are enabling tzar bali chayim, you're enabling gratuitous pain inflicted on animals.
My mom didn't eat veal because she just, like, it was her moral thing, like, she thought it was unethical, like, not because of any Jewish reason, just, like, her personal beliefs.
Well, looks like your mother intuitively.
Is backed up by the Torah.
Yeah, your mother and Rav Moshe Feinstein came to the same conclusion on veal. So, there you go. That's the Yiddish neshama. She and got, you know, learning right now about this should serve as Aliyah's neshama. It should be a merit for her.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's get to the end of this Gemara. It's almost Mincha, and hopefully people who walk through, they'll see that the chapel had a little flooding, but it's cleaned up mostly, but there are fans on that are very loud. I don't want to play around with the equipment, so we might have to dive in the lobby. Okay, but Masiv Rava. Rava's going to question something. We learned that that there's something called a lav haba mechlal say, that if I have a positive commandment that says, do this, like, eat from the karbon after the throwing of the blood, I can infer that I'm not supposed to eat before. Okay, very, very basic logic. Masiv Rava, Rava has found a contradiction. It says in the verse, "V'chol behema afreses parsos v'shosah shesa shtei parsos malas geira v'behema osa tochel." It says any animal that has split hooves and that chews its cud, from these animals, you're allowed to eat. Huh. Vegan tikka amrit. Well, if that's true, that I can infer that if it says in the Torah, I'm only allowed to eat from animals that chew their cud and have split hooves, then I can infer that it's usher for me to eat any animal that doesn't chew its cud and have split hooves. If that's true, why does it need to say, why did it need to tell me in the Torah from these animals, it lists like bunny rabbits and different animals that are non-kosher, these animals you shouldn't eat. Lumali, if the Torah told me you're only allowed to eat from animals that chew their cud and have split hooves, it doesn't need to go ahead and then delineate and to enumerate all different kinds of animals that I'm not allowed to eat. I would infer from the fact that there's a positive statement in the Torah that you may eat from these animals that have split hooves and chew their cud, I would infer anything that doesn't chew its cud and have split hooves, I'm not allowed to eat from its usher. So then why, if that's true that I can make inferences like that in halacha, then why does the Torah need to tell me don't eat from these non-kosher animals? I would already know I'm not allowed to eat from them because the Torah told me I can only eat from the kosher animals. Yes, Sammy.
Aren't bunnies also like under the same category as snakes and that they're lower to the ground, so you can't eat them?
I don't remember the particular reason why, but basically because they don't have both criteria, split hooves and chewing cud.
I just remember like when we were studying Parshat Shmini, like
oh, well, like Shrutzen you're thinking about. Like,
I have no idea.
Okay, that's good. That's good memory. Yes. There is idea of
like
different animals.
Snakes.
So we have animals that are like Shrutzen that we talked about in the previous week, which are like we call the creepy crawly things on the ground. And some of these might fall in these categories. Yeah, so very good. So a few, like 2 weeks ago, we talked about this in the Gemara. And so I think bunnies are. You know what's funny, actually? You're talking about an arnevis, a rabbit. So the Gemara Megillah is one of the candidates for the next Gemara we're going to do together, God willing.
Okay.
So Megillah, it talks about how the sages were forced to translate the Torah into Greek. And the issue was they didn't want to translate certain things because the Greeks would think that they were doing it to be offensive. So one of them was, I think my recollection was that the wife of the Caesar's name was something like a rabbit, and they thought by saying that the arnevis, that the rabbit, is listed as one of the things that's usher for you to eat, he would take it as a slight against his wife and then put all the sages to death. So they had to play around when they translated into Greek, lest his ire be evoked on everybody. So that's what that reminds me of. Okay, but the question is, Rabosai, if I'm allowed to infer a losase, a negative commandment from a positive commandment, why do I need the Torah to list all these things I'm not allowed to eat? I can infer I'm not allowed to eat them because they don't meet the criteria for what I'm allowed to eat. So the Gemara accepts this question and therefore says, Eli Itmar Hachi Itmar. Rather, this is not what Rav Gidal said. Amar Rav Gidal, Amar Rav. Rather, what did Rav Gidal teach? He taught something different. We misunderstood it. We're not talking about a Kohen right now. Zar shalach mechantas asham of nezrika potter. A Yisrael who eats a mechantas and asham offering. Now Yisrael is not supposed to eat mechantas and asham. Only a kohen is allowed to. However, here's the interesting detail. Let's say the Yisrael eats it lifnezrika potter. Before the throwing of the blood, he would not incur malchus for eating the chatas and asham. At least inherently for being a czar, non-Kohen. Why? My taima, damar krav, achluosam asher kupar behem. Because it says in the verse, and they shall eat from it after the atonement has been fulfilled for them, after the blood has been thrown. Kol hichad de karinam be, achluosam asher kupar behem, karinam be, vizar lo yokal kodesh. It's only when the food becomes eligible for the Kohanim to eat it, does it then become usur for the Yisraelim to eat it? But since the Karban, prior to the blood being thrown, the Kohen is not supposed to partake in it yet. Therefore, the prohibition for the Yisrael to partake in it does not yet apply. Only once there's a mitzvah for the Kohen dafka, specifically to eat it, is Yisrael excluded from eating it. But since Kohanim are not eligible to eat from it prior to the throwing of the blood, there wouldn't be any inherent infraction on the part of Yisrael of eating the chatas and asham offering before the throwing of the blood for being a Yisrael as opposed to a Kohen. Now, he would get malchus, however, for eating it before the throwing of the blood, which a Kohen would be punished for. But he won't be punished intrinsically for being a Yisrael because it's not incumbent upon the Kohen to eat it yet until the blood is thrown, and therefore he's not excluded until the point of the blood being thrown. So therefore, whenever the Kohen is not mandated to eat from it, i.e. before the blood is thrown, lo karina bevezer lo yochal, we do not invoke the pasuk of a zar shall not eat from it. So again, he'll get malchus for other reasons, but he won't get malchus. He won't get malchus for being a zar. Now, that brings us to the end of the Gemara. I want to share just one last idea before we end. We touched on, and you know, Sammy brought this up, we talked about Tsar Bali Chaim, which is the principle that forbids us from gratuitously harming animals. Now, why do I say gratuitously? That's a very important point, meaning needlessly harming animals. The question comes up, and this is very important. We only have 3 minutes, so we're not going to, I'll do it between Mincha Amar, maybe on Shabbos. We'll talk about abortion, actually, halacha, because it's in the, yeah, because of Texas, it's in the headlines again, and it's always important not to let the pundits tell us what Judaism holds about abortion, but God willing, we'll try to explore the different sides of it in between Mincha Amar this Shabbos. Rabbi Cohen asked me to speak, but so we're not getting into all the halakhos of abortion yet, but what we do know is that if the mother's life is in danger for a human being, everyone holds you can abort the baby to save the mother's life. The question is, when it comes to I can hear my voice twice. When it comes to the animal having to get the abortion, do we also kill, right? Because basically, in theory, it could, meaning the mother cow is having issues giving birth. And so you have to choose the same way it works for a human being. I mean, you know, terrible thing no one should ever have to go through. So are you allowed to abort the baby? Well, on one hand, maybe it should be the same principle as human beings. You should be able to kill the baby to save the mother. On the other hand, Shemayesh Lachosh Litzar Ha'ubar Shugadamo Bechatichas Yadam. Maybe the child, the Ubar, the fetus, will suffer so much pain due to Tsar Bali Chayim. One should not be allowed to abort the fetus. So that's the question. Is one allowed to do that? So there's a lot of discussion to get into, but basically what I want to share with you is, as Libertine says, a very important principle in Tsar Bali Chaim. Tsar Bali Chaim is only forbidden when it's gratuitous, when it's done for no constructive purpose. However, when there is a purpose to it, there's no Tsar Bali Chaim. And therefore, since one is saving the mother by aborting the child, it would not constitute Tsar Bali Chaim. Because Tsar Bali Chaim is only when it's done gratuitously, but when it's done for a constructive purpose, it would be permissible. And therefore, on that basis, he says that one would be able to abort the cow fetus in that case. God willing, we'll talk more about the halachos of the abortion because it's in the headlines once again. And we should, of course, understand that it's a nuanced issue from a Jewish standpoint. And mincha is in 1 minute, so we will end the shiur now. Thank you all for coming on Zoom and in person.
Thank you.